Do not go into the dark. This is a witchcraft. Those are not animals out there. His words stopped Butzo at the threshold. There was nothing of flesh and blood he would not face, but this. The fiendish chorus reached a climax and then abruptly ceased. The silence that followed was even more chilling, and Butzo shrank away from the door. His companions crouched on their sleeping mats, weapons in their hands, their eyes wide and white in the firelight, but not one of them moved towards the door. All of Gundung's kraal was awake now, but silent, waiting, the women creeping away into the furthest recesses of their huts and covering their heads with their fur karosses, the men frozen with superstitious terror. The silence lasted the time it would take for a man to run the full circle of the stockade, and then was broken by the call of a single hyena, the same whooping cry starting low and rising to a shriek. The head of every one of the warriors in Butzo's hut lifted, and they all stared upwards to the roof and the star-pricked sky above it, for that was from where the ghostly cry emanated, from the very air high above Gundung's kraal.
Sorcery!
Camuzo's voice shook, and Butzo choked down on the wail of terror that rose in his own throat. As the animal cry died in the night, there was only one other sound, the voice of a young girl raised in terrible distress.
Butzo! Help me, Butzo!
It was the only thing that could have roused him. Butzo shook himself like a dog that leaps from water to land, throwing off the terror that paralysed him.
Do not go! Camuzo yelled after him. It is not the girl, it is a witch voice!
But Butzo tore the locking bar from the door. He saw her immediately. Tanasi raced towards him from the women's quarters, from Juba's own great hut, where she had been passing the last night before her nuptials. Her dark, naked body was without substance, like a moon shadow as she sped to him. Butzo leapt towards her, and they met in front of the main gate of the stockade, and Tanasi clung to him. No other person had left the huts. The kraal was deserted, the fearful silence oppressive. Butzo lifted his shield to cover both himself and the girl, and instinctively he turned to face the gateway. It was only then that he realized that the gate was open. He tried to retreat towards the hut, taking the girl with him, but she was rigid in his arms, rooted to the earth like the stump of a wild ebony tree, and his own strength was sapped by terror.
Butzo, Tanasi whispered, it is them. They have come.
As she spoke, the watchfire beside the gate, which had long ago burned down to ash and charred logs, suddenly burst into flame once again. The flames sprang higher than a man's head, roaring like a waterfall, and the stockade and gateway were lit brightly by the yellow dancing light. Beyond the open gateway, at the very edge of the firelight, stood a human figure. It was the figure of a very old man, with stick-like limbs and bowed back. His cap of hair was white as the salt from the makarikari pan. His skin was grey and dusty with age. The whites of his eyes flashed as they squinted and rolled upwards into his skull, and glassy strings of spittle dribbled from his toothless mouth onto his chest, wetting the dry parchment skin through which each skeletal rib stood out clearly. His voice was a quavering ancient squeal.
Tanasi!
He called.
Tanasi, daughter of the spirits!
In the firelight, all life went out of Tanasi's eyes. They became blank.
Do not heed, Butzo croaked.
But a bluish sheen appeared over Tanasi's eyeballs, like the nictitating membrane that covers the eye of a shark or the cataract of tropical ophthalmia, and blindly her head turned towards the spectral figure beyond the gates.
Tanasi, your destiny calls you!
She broke out of Butzo's arms. It seemed to require no effort. He could not hold her. Her strength was superhuman. She began to walk towards the gateway, and when Butzo tried to follow her, he found he could not lift a foot. He dropped his shield, and it clattered on the hard earth, but Tanasi did not look back. She walked with a floating grace, light as river mist, towards the ancient stooped figure.
Tanasi!
Butzo's voice was a despairing cry, and he fell upon his knees, yearning after her. The old man held out one hand,
and Ta-Nehisi took it. And as she did so, the watchfire died down as abruptly as it had flared, and the darkness beyond the gateway was instantly impenetrable. "Ta-Nehisi," whispered Bazo, his arms outstretched. And far away, down by the river, the hyena called one last time. The twins came pelting into the church, tumbling over each other with eagerness to be the first to tell.
"Mama, Mama! Vicky, I saw her first. Let me..."
Robin Codrington looked up from the black body stretched on the table and quelled them with a frown. "Ladies, don't push." They came up in a parody of demureness, but hopping with impatience. "Very well, Vicky, what is it?" They began together, and Robin stopped them again. "I said Vicky." And Victoria puffed up importantly.
"There's someone coming."
"From Tabas and Dunas?" Robin asked.
"No, Mama, from the south."
"It's probably one of the king's messengers."
"No, Mama, it's a white man on a horse."
Robin's interest quickened. She would never have admitted to herself how often the isolation palled. A white traveller would mean news, perhaps letters, stores and supplies, or even the most precious of all, books. Failing those treasures, there would be the mere mental stimulation of a strange face and of conversation and ideas. She was tempted to leave the patient on the table. It was not a serious burn, but she checked herself. "Tell Papa I shall come directly," she said. And the twins fled, jammed in the doorway for a moment, and then popped through like a cork from a champagne bottle. By the time Robin had finished dressing the burn, dismissed the patient, washed her hands, and hurried out onto the porch of the church, the stranger was coming up the hill. Clinton was leading the mule on which he was mounted. It was a big, strong-looking grey animal, so the rider looked small and slim upon the broad back. He was a lad, dressed in an old tweed jacket and a boy's cloth cap. The twins danced on each side of the mule, and Clinton at its head was looking back over his shoulder, listening to something that the stranger was saying.
"Who is it, Mama?"
Selina came out of the kitchen and called across the yard. "We shall find out in a moment." Clinton led the mule to the porch, and the rider's head was on a level with Robin's.
Dr. Ballantyne, your grandfather, Dr. Moffat, sent me to you. I have letters and gifts from him for you."
With a start, Robin realized that under the patched tweed coat and cap was a woman. And even in that moment of surprise, she was aware that it was an extraordinarily handsome woman, younger than Robin herself, not much over 30 years of age, with steady, dark eyes and almost Mongolian cheekbones. She jumped down from the mule with the agility of an expert horsewoman and came up the steps of the porch to seize Robin's hands. Her grip was firm as a man's, and her expression was intense. "My husband is ill and suffering. Dr. Moffat says you are the only one who can help him. Will you do it? Oh, please, will you?" "I am a doctor." Robin gently twisted her fingers out of the other woman's painful grip. But it was not that which troubled her. There was something too intense, too passionate about her. "I am a doctor, and I could never refuse to help anyone who is suffering. Of course, I shall do whatever I can."
"Do you promise that?"
the woman insisted, and Robin bridled slightly.
"I have said I will help. There is no need to promise."
"Oh, thank you," the woman smiled with relief.
"Where is your husband?"
"Not far behind. I rode ahead to warn you and to make sure that you would help us."
"What is it that ails your husband?"
"Dr. Moffat has explained it all in a letter. He sent gifts for you also." The woman was evasive, turning away from Robin's scrutiny and running back to the mule. From the saddlebag she lifted down two packages, wrapped in oilskin to protect them against the elements, and bound up with rawhide thongs. They were so heavy and bulky that Clinton took them from her and carried them into the church.
"You are tired," Robin said. "I am sorry I cannot offer you coffee. We used the last a month ago. But a glass of lemonade?"
"No," the woman shook her head decidedly. "I shall go back immediately to be with my husband. But we shall arrive before nightfall." She ran back and vaulted lightly to the mule's back. None of them had ever seen a woman do that.
Thank you,
she repeated, and then trotted out of the yard, back down the hill. Clinton came out of the church and put one arm around Robin's shoulders. What a very beautiful and unusual woman, he said. And Robin nodded. That was one of the things that had troubled her. Robin mistrusted beautiful women. What is her name? She asked. I didn't have a chance to ask. You were too busy looking, perhaps, Robin suggested tartly, and wriggled out from under his arm and went back into the church, while Clinton stared after her with a rueful expression. After a moment, he made a move as if to follow her, but then sighed and shook his head. It was always as well to let Robin come round on her own. Coaxing only angered her even more unreasonably. In the quiet of the church, Robin untied the first package and unpacked the contents onto the table. There were 5 heavy bottles with glass stoppers, and she read the labels as she lifted out each one. Carbolic acid, alum, quicksilver, iodine. And then the 5th bottle was labelled trichloromethane. Bless you, grandfather, she smiled delightedly, but still she unstoppered the last bottle and sniffed cautiously at the mouth to confirm her good fortune. The pungent sweet odour was unmistakable. Chloroform was to her more precious than her own life's blood. She would gladly have exchanged drop for drop. Her own last supply had been exhausted months before, and the London Missionary Society was as parsimonious as ever with its stores. She wished she had retained just a few hundred guineas of her enormous book royalties to enable her to purchase her own medicines, rather than having to plead for them with the secretary in London by a correspondence which often took 12 months each way. Sometimes, in a flagrantly unchristian manner, she wished she could have that bloodless, myopic little man at her side when she removed an eye damaged by a blow with a knobkerry and hanging out of its socket onto a black cheek, or when she went for a caesarean section, all without anaesthetic. She hugged the bottle to her chest for a moment. "Darling grandfather," she repeated. Then, as reverently, as if it were the fabulous Kohinoor diamond, she set the bottle of colourless but precious fluid aside and turned to the 2nd package. A roll of newspapers, the Cape Times and the Diamond Fields Advertiser. In the weeks ahead, every column would be read and re-read, down to the announcement of auction sales and the legal notices. Then the newsprint itself would be used for a dozen domestic chores, under the newspaper, books. Wonderful, fat, leather-bound books. Bless you, Robert Moffat. She lifted out a translation of Ibsen's An Enemy of the People. She admired the Norwegian for his insight into the human mind and the muted poetry of his prose. Robert Louis Stevenson's Virginibus Peresqui. The title made her pause. She had 4 virgins in her household, and she intended maintaining that happy condition without allowing any inflammatory literature to thwart her. She flipped through the book. Despite the dubious title, it was merely a collection of essays, and the man was a good Calvinistic Scot. It might just do to let the girls read it, but she would vet it first. Then there was Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer. Here she was less sanguine. She had heard of this American's frivolous and irreverent attitude towards adolescence, industry, and filial duty. She would read it carefully before letting it anywhere near Selina or Catherine. Reluctantly, she left the other books for future study and turned to her grandfather's letter. There were many pages, written with sooty homemade ink, and the script was shaky and wavering. She skimmed swiftly through the salutations and the personal news until she reached the middle of the 2nd page. Robin, they say a doctor buries his mistakes. Blatantly untrue. I send mine to you. The patient who delivers this letter should long ago have sought the sanctuary of a modern hospital such as that at Kimberley. This he has steadfastly refused to do. His reasons are his own, and I have not pried. However, the fact that for over a year now he has had a pistol ball lodged in his body may point to his motives. Twice I have cut for this foreign body, but at 87 years of age my eyes are not as bright nor my hand as steady as yours. Each time I have failed, and I fear that I have done more harm than good. I know that you have interest and skill in treatment of this type of injury. As so you should, for you have been provided by young Lobengula's warriors with endless opportunity to practice your technique. I recall with admiration your inspired reintroduction of the Spoon of Darkleys after nearly 2,000 years, which you designed from the contemporary description by Celsus, and your successful removal of barbed arrowheads with it. Thus I send you one more subject on which to demonstrate your art, and with him my very last bottle of chloroform, for the poor fellow, whatever his sins, has suffered enough under my knife. The letter left her with a sense of foreboding, as did the woman who had delivered it. She folded the letter and thrust it into the pocket of her skirt as she left the church and hurried across the yard. "Kathy," she called, "where is that girl?" "She must set the guest house to rights." "She's gone to it already, Mama." Selina looked up as she stormed into the kitchen. "Then where is your father?" Within an hour, the mission station was prepared to receive guests, and buzzing with anticipation. But they had to wait until mid-afternoon before a two-wheeled cart of unusually high and heavy construction appeared over the rise before the river. It was drawn by a pair of mules. The entire family assembled on the front porch of the main building, and all of them had changed their clothing, while the girls had also brushed and dressed their hair with ribbons. A dozen times the twins had to be cautioned for improper comments and unrestrained behaviour, but finally the cart wheeled into the yard. The woman had put her mule into the traces, and now she walked beside the wheel of the cart, which reached almost as high as her head. There was a coloured servant in ragged cast-off clothes leading the mules, and over the body of the cart was rigged a makeshift sunshade of saplings and stained canvas. Below the porch the cart stopped, and all of them craned forward as a man's head and upper body appeared above its side. He was laid on a straw mattress on the floor of the cart, and now he lifted himself on one elbow. He was a gaunt, wasted figure. The flesh seemed to have melted from the big bones of his shoulders. His cheeks had fallen in and turned a muddy yellow. The hand on the side of the cart was bony, and the veins were roped under the skin like blue serpents. His hair bushed wildly about his head, coarse dark hair that was shot through with strands of dead white. He had not shaved in days. Thick stubble covered his jaws and was salted with the same white as his hair. One eye was sunk into a bruised cavity, and it had that feverish glitter that Robin recognized instantly. It was the look of mortal illness. The other eye was covered with a black piratical patch. There was something dreadfully familiar about the big aquiline nose and the wide mouth. Yet it was only when he smiled that old, mocking, yet somehow tender smile that she had never forgotten that Robin reeled backwards, one hand flying to her mouth too late to stop her cry. She caught for support at one of the mopani poles that held the roof. "Mama, are you all right?" But Robin pushed Selina's hands away and went on staring at the man in the cart. Only one memory out of so many rose up like a freak wave out of a storm-swept sea to overwhelm her. She saw again that dark bush of curls, devoid only of its silver lacing, bowing to her naked bosom. She saw above her the beamed roof of the great cabin in the stern quarters of the slave ship Huron, and she remembered, as she had 1,000 times in the 20 years since then, that pain, the deep, splitting incursion that rocked her. 4 childbirths since then had not eradicated the memory of it, the agony of passing from maiden to woman. Her senses wavered. There was a rushing in her ears. She was going to fall. But then Clinton's voice steadied her, the hard, fierce tone of it, which she had not heard in years. "You!" he said. As Clinton drew himself erect, the years seemed to fall away from him. He was once again tall and lithe, stiff with anger as the young Royal Naval officer who had come up onto the slaver's quarter-deck with pistols and a naval cutlass on his hip to confront this same man. Still clinging to the veranda pole, Robin remembered the words he had spoken then, in that same fierce tone. "Captain Mungo St. John, your reputation precedes you, sir." The first trader ever to transport more than 3,000 souls across the Middle Passage in a single 12-month period. I'd give 5 years' pay to have the hatches off your hold, sir.